Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled, Nirvana and Samsara Are the Same. Wait, what? Part 2 by Eric Weinberg. Part 1 of this talk, given in February, focused on walking the path of wisdom by meditating on the view. Part 2 will focus on accumulating merit. In the sutras, the Buddha repeatedly states that the higher levels cannot be practiced in a stable manner unless they develop on a strong foundation. The pursuit of merit provides that foundation. To paraphrase a modern Buddhist psychologist, one cannot wisely let go of one's sense of self until one has developed a wise sense of self. The pursuit of merit is the Buddhist way to develop a wise sense of self. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Today, I am doing part two of a talk that I began back in February. And the title was, Nirvana and Samsara Are the Same. Wait, what? And the first part of the talk was the wisdom piece. Wisdom, from a Buddhist point of view, is not hard to understand, actually. It's psychologically difficult to engender, but it's not hard to understand. And that talk was about interdependence and how, while we think we're all separate units, everything, including us, is connected to everything. Everything arises interdependently, including us. And so the idea of wisdom is creating a condition in our mind where we can begin to act with a sense of connectedness rather than with a sense of selfishness and aloneness or loneliness. Along with that, I passed out a prayer that has one misspelling in it, you might find it. And I made some more copies for people, and I think depends on how the time goes, I think I'd like to have us pray it together today. Anybody who wants to have one, I don't know if I made enough copies for everybody here, but we can share. And anybody who wants to take it home with them, you should feel free. So, and at the end, I'm bucking tradition a little bit. I also kind of put together the words of two dedication of merit prayers, one by Lama Zopa Rinpoche and the other one by His Eminence Garchen Rinpoche. And I mashed them up because it seemed like it made a wonderful dedication for the talk that I intend to give. So I'd like to pass those out too before we get started. Thank you. In the meantime, I want to begin this Dharma talk in the way that we do traditionally begin Dharma talks here, with chanting the refuge prayer together three times. What I want you to keep in mind is that while we say that we're taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, recognize that Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, it does indeed exist all around us. Also, completely exists within us as well. And that the path of Dharma is a path of unfolding what needs to be unfolded so we can directly experience this profound nature that's already here, that's already around us and already within us.
Sanje Chudang Soki Chognam La Chang Chu Pardu Dani Kyab Suchi Dagi Jin So Hipe Sunam Ki Drola Pinshir Sanje Gruparshom Sanje Chudang Soki Chognam La Chang Chu Pardu Dani Kyab Suchi Agi Jin So Yipe Sonam Ki Drola Penchir Sanje Rupar Sho Sanje Chudam So Ki Chognam La Chang Chu Pardu Dagni Kyamtsuji Dagi Jin So Gipe Sonam Ki Rola Penchu Sanje Rupar Sho.
So we talked about this wisdom part, and if you want to look at that again or hear it for the first time, I think it's on the Facebook channel, the YouTube channel, all those places, and available on the KTC website. It's taught that achieving our aspiration to enlightenment for the benefit of all beings depends on two accumulations. The first is the accumulation of wisdom. Kind of gives us the view, gives us what things look like from a person who is open to wisdom. And the other is the accumulation of merit. It's an interesting thing because we all have some idea of what merit is, except we really don't. It's often mistaken in the Western culture as kind of collecting a bunch of good works in order to earn enough brownie points to get to heaven or something like that. And it's not like that at all. One of the images that is used by teachers that I've had is that our life is like that of a bird. And our aspirations are what takes the bird in a particular direction. So in our case, if we aspire to be enlightened for the benefit of all beings, well, there you go, that's the direction. The bird has two wings. One of them is wisdom, absolutely necessary. The other is merit. And the bird just can't fly without both wings. And so we talk about those things explicitly and in some detail. In a way, I'd like to, at this point, just put ourselves into the wisdom mind by reciting this prayer together. I think we'll have time. In order that I may be skilled in discerning what is good, in order that I may understand the path to peace, let me be able, upright and straightforward, of good speech, gentle, confident, and courageous. Let me be contented, easily satisfied, having few duties, living simply, of controlled senses, prudent, without pride and without clinging to nation, race, or other groups. Let me not do the slightest thing for which the wise might rebuke me. Instead, let me think. May all beings be well and safe. May they be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether moving or standing still, without exception, whether large, great, middling, or small, whether tiny or substantial, whether seen or unseen, whether living near or far, born or unborn, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive or despise another anywhere. Let none wish harm to another in anger or in hate. Just as a mother would guard her only child with her own life, even so let me cultivate a boundless mind for all beings in the world, whether standing, walking, seated, or lying down. Let me cultivate a boundless love for all beings in the world, above, below, and across, unhindered, without fixed views, ill will, or enmity. May I be pure-hearted and free of agitation. May I be free of torpor and remain open, always recollecting this aspiration. This, they say, is the divine life right here. So there it is. Like I said, easy to say, maybe not so easy to do. We need to work on ourselves. And in part, some of that work is the accumulation of merit. This is kind of a working hypothesis for wisdom. When you're really in it, they say there aren't even any words for it. It's beyond description. So, in order to talk about wisdom, which is the more concrete thing, it's kind of what we do. Everything we do creates a mental imprint, creates karma. Karma just means action. That's all it means. People like project all kinds of other things out there. But the teaching is that we can, with every action, with every thought, with every emotion, create a positive imprint or a negative imprint, right? And there's a balance. The process of creating positive imprints is really what the accumulation of a merit is. That's really what it is. And so, obviously, we all get angry, we all get jealous. We all, especially me, have a lot of pride. And, there's lust or overweening desire, blind desire for all kinds of things. And they all get in our way. Those are called the afflictive emotions. We all forget our real nature is the same as the Buddha's. That's called ignorance. That's probably the biggest negative emotion of all, just the state of bewilderment. But there are opposites to that. And that's what we want to talk about a little bit here. Instead of selfishness, generosity. Instead of jealousy, rejoicing in somebody's good fortune and having the confidence that you actually have everything you need to accomplish everything that you need to accomplish, and so forth. Earlier this week on Facebook, our Dharma sister Sue Earlywine posted a little part of a poem by the great Sufi poet Rumi, and I want to use that as a basis for what we're talking about here. He said, "The truth was a mirror in the hands of God. It fell and broke into pieces. Everybody took a piece from it, and they looked at it, and they thought they had the truth." Chogyal Namgye Norbu, who was a great Nyingma teacher, used to tell the story that when Buddha Shakyamuni died, his 18 disciples quarreled over doctrinal issues, and founded 18 separate schools. Why did they do that? You would think if they were right next to the Buddha, they all would have gotten it, right? Well, maybe not. They had some work to do too. He says it's because each of them heard and understood something different, sometimes contradictory to what the others had understood. We are in a dualistic vision in which everything seems solid to us, and therefore, if I'm right, and of course I have it, then you cannot have it. You cannot be right. People have different political beliefs, follow different spiritual paths, and run every day. But the spiritual path should help us get rid of this kind of problem. Otherwise, we let ourselves be closed in another system of restrictions. Therefore, we should use our mind to recognize our limitations and understand that the problem is not that we are right and others do not have it, only that we follow a dualistic vision. So it occurred to me that one way to define merit in a very general way could be doing anything that we can to reconnect the pieces of the mirror of truth. In other words, not just hold on our little piece, but to find ways, develop qualities, take action to reconnect with the truth of another, with the sacred truth and the heart of another. And that could be in the heart of an animal. It could be in the heart of the whole earth. It could be in the hearts of one another. And that's our work. That's how we accumulate merit. In the Vajrayana, the tradition that we practice here, we're given practices that are brilliant and beautifully designed to help train our bodies, our speech, and our minds in the skills and means that we need to do just that. Because actually, you know, from birth, we fall quickly into the illusion that we're separate and so forth, and that what I want is more important than anybody. I mean, people say they want to become innocent and like babies. Don't become innocent and like a baby. Babies are totally self-centered and, you know, and can be very annoying. There's a baby right next door to us, was just born like a month ago. I love the baby, but I don't have to sleep at night, you know? Babies want what they want when they want it, need what they need when they need it. They're not interested in seeing your sacred truth or your piece of the mirror and connecting with it, except for the fact that you may give them what they think they want in a given moment. So as we mature, we need some methods, because our mental habit right from birth, right from the beginning, is a habit of trying to get what we want regardless of what anybody else might need or desire. People ask all the time, well, Eric, you say Buddha nature is inherent. We all have it. We all have the same amount, the same quality, the same nature as the Buddha. So why do we need to practice? We just like accept that and move on. Well, the truth is we've got all these propensities and habits and karmas and mental imprints that we've deepened again and again and again by our behavior, by our thoughts, by our emotional reactivity and so forth. And so when something comes to us, something we see, something we smell, something we taste, something we hear, something we feel, something we think. Before we know it, before we can get our arms around, we have a reaction to that. And that's why we need to practice. We need to create a little bit of space so that wisdom can shine on that experience. Otherwise, what we do, of course, is we react and then we think, well, that's me, right? That's my personality, that's who I am, and then we have to make up a story that defends that me, and we end up separating ourselves little by little our whole life long. And we end up suffering. The whole Buddha Dharma is simply, according to the Buddha, a method, a path that we can walk that will utterly destroy suffering. And so that's what we're choosing to do. And the practice is, because this is a little bit hard to mess around with our own reactions and our own personalities and so forth. What we're doing when we do these practices where we visualize ourselves as a Buddha is we're retraining ourselves to see ourselves differently and to see everything else that we look at differently. For a minute, we can imagine that we have the eyes of a Buddha, and we can get used to that a little bit. And little by little, we make those imprints. And by making those imprints little by little, we start to change. We start to have a little more spaciousness in the way that we just move through life. And within that spaciousness, that allows room for our aspiration to goodness, like this prayer that we just prayed, to kind of get some traction in our activity and in what we do. And we can begin to act out of a little bit more intentionality and a little more wisdom. And when we act that way, see, that accumulates merit, because that reconnects us to what it is that is in front of us in our life. And we all get different stuff to connect to, right? Ultimately, everything that you can imagine is connected, of course. But really, right now, you know, there's the, whatever it is, 30 or 35 of us here that are connected very directly. And you may think, I wish he wouldn't talk so much, or he's boring, or, you know, anything could be happening in your mind right now, or this is interesting, I wish he wouldn't just go off on tangents like this. And, you know, like, because that's what happens, you hear something, and that's how subtle it is. The ideas go around in your brain, and then you react to how you're receiving it, and all of a sudden, that reaction is you, it's a me, it's solid, it's here. And there's no room to say, I want to be open to how this is unfolding. I want to listen warmly, and so forth. So, that's why we practice. And frankly, that's why practice is better if you don't just do kind of hero's journey and plan a retreat and go away for 10 days once in a blue moon and do something like really hard, you know, like running a spiritual marathon or something. That doesn't help much, because we're making imprints all day long. However, if we practice a little bit every day and get used to this and begin to apply it, it's very powerful. Because that's what we're working with. And when we talk about accumulating merit, there are big things we do. We build stupas, we fill statues, we build this amazing shrine room, we write checks to Columbus KTC or other charitable organizations and do generosity, that's all merit. It's all wonderful. But the most powerful merit is moving step by step along this path. And so practice itself, when you commit yourself to say, I'm going to meditate for 5 minutes every day, or I'm going to meditate for 10 minutes every day, whatever, something very modest and doable, it's enormous. The merit is enormous. Just looking at the time, we're good. So the thing about merit, if you really look at it this way, it requires a sense of humility. You got to have a sense that I don't have it. See, the 18 close disciples of the Buddha, their issue really was pride. They each thought they had it. They each thought they were right. For us, it's good to engender a sense of humility in the face of the pervasive and dynamic losing of consciousness that we all experience moment to moment because of those reactions, like the reactions you may be having to this talk. Rather than kicking yourself, or rather than defending yourself, you know, much better to just accept in humility, oh, did that again. Because then you can practice with it. We need to keep that all the time because our minds are acting the way they act all the time. We need mindful awareness and the accumulation of merit and wisdom that comes from the conditions mindful awareness creates for us. That's what happens. His Holiness, the 16th Karmapa, talks about this. And this is what he said. You are constantly busy. The truth of cyclic existence is very well manifested in your lives. To remedy this state of affairs, one first needs to calm down. Do not be completely absorbed in your surroundings. Develop some degree of stillness. Cultivate simple control of mind, tranquility. At least some openness of the mind needs to be developed. The notion of perception and perceiver has existed from beginningless time and is part of the pattern of clinging. From beginningless time, our shortcomings have been to fall back into samsara. In the past, in the future, and in the present, the mind has always been, in many ways, very playful. But where the true nature of mind is concerned, neither the color, nor the shape, nor the location of the mind, nor its consciousness can even be pinpointed. The nature of mind goes beyond all such substantialities. This being so, in the meditation practice, it's important neither to invite the future nor recollect the past, but to remain in the state of nowness. The nowness of mind is the practice which should be developed by you all. Wow. Being here now, just like Ram Dass said, be here now, be here now. We always find ourselves kind of carried away. There's a regret that comes up thinking about things in the past. That's what meditation's for. We learn to drop a thought in order to experience the openness of this moment. There's anxiety about what might happen in the future. I don't know about you, but everything I've worried about, I'm really bad. My crystal ball is really bad. I'm always wrong. Everything I'm worried will happen doesn't happen. And then things that do happen, you know, surprise me. And if I'm have the mental habit of always being anxious about the future, I don't handle those surprises very well. You know, I have all that reactivity, and so what happens? Do I accumulate merit? No, I accumulate some negative karma, another habitual imprint that only creates the causes for more suffering. So, I submit to you that the highest, best way to accumulate merit, there are many ways to do it, but the best way is to every day engender every moment you can with practice. That means on the cushion, for sure, and off the cushion as much as possible. And I've got a sweet little practice to share with you for that at the end of this. So there are lots of ways of repairing this broken mirror of truth. And, you know, opportunities come up all the time for charity, for building sacred objects, for creating a harmonious environment, like for the neighbors next door who have a new baby, and, you know, I can pick the baby up and take it on a walk so they can get a breather. See, this creates an environment in which they can pull their shattered lives back together. And then I can encourage them, of course, and tell them that they have now entered the 18-year retreat. That's what we call it. You know, we can build mandalas, we can build stupas, all that kind of stuff. We can hang prayer flags, thinking, of course, that as the wind blows through the flags, it's sending blessings everywhere. It's all good. But underneath all of that, we have to do what Karmapa says, which is we have to get in touch with our own sacred truth, the profound nature of our mind. In Buddhism, we begin by taking refuge. That's how we begin all practices. That's how we began today. And I think that this first idea of practicing off the cushion is to say, okay, yeah, when you get up in the morning, take refuge. Just first thing. But don't just like let taking refuge be opening ceremonies of the Olympics or something, the Olympics of your day. Let it be something that kind of infuses every moment, because really what we're talking about here is we can create merit by taking refuge in the Buddha, which is recognizing that Buddha's always here. It's pulling for us, rooting for us, our ally. Buddha wants to see nothing more than you be enlightened. That's what they're rooting for, the Buddha. So you take refuge, depend on that. Buddha's also the fundamental nature of who you are. It is your sacred truth. Take refuge in your sacred truth more than in your sense of I'm me and this is my story, and getting lost in, you know, chasing around like that. And then I write here, I say, we're taking refuge from surrendering to the swamp of seeing everything through the eyes of what's going to happen to me, and shift that to taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, which resonate with the nature of your own mind. It's like two tuning forks tuned in the same way. You strike one and it vibrates, and without even touching the other will start vibrating too. And that's why we take refuge formally in the morning. We want to strike that tuning fork and wake that vibration up in our own heart. Buddha is your awakened nature. Practicing Dharma introduces a resonance that brings it to life. Dharma is the quality of your presence, the atmosphere of the six perfections. And from that comes the ability to bring those qualities to life, joining the activity of the Sangha through your activity of body, speech, and mind. That kind of activity accumulates merit. When we talk about compassion, which is one of the fundamental activities of this merit accumulation, that's a word that people get confused by. It's important to know what we mean by compassion. Compassion starts with empathy. Empathy is feeling what someone else is feeling or something else is feeling. Compassion, though, is actually being able to remove the suffering of another. Wow. And that's why it's considered, on the one hand, the highest practice, because it requires extraordinary mindfulness and sensitivity and also skill. And that's what practices are designed to do, is to cultivate in us over time, and it takes time, this sensitivity and some of these skills that help us transform into compassionate beings to share in the activity of the Sangha and create merit in that way. So Dharma practice is a way of bringing our minds into a state where we experience the activities and qualities of Buddha again and again and again. So here's the thing. One of the practices that we do is called Chenrezig practice. It's interesting. We all know that that's the practice of the Buddha of compassion, and you know, Chenrezig engenders the compassion of all the Buddhas. And so by doing Chenrezig practice, we're training ourselves in this way to develop the wisdom, the sensitivity to reality, the openness to reality that we need in order to be compassionate, right? And then it also trains our minds in ways to work with reality so that we can, you know, operate skillfully. And I'm not going to get into the fundamentals right now. Chenrezig practice, something more basic. You know, originally when it came from India, Chenrezig was actually in Sanskrit Avalokiteshvara. That was the name of the Bodhisattva of compassion in Sanskrit. It occurred to me some time ago, well, what does Avalokiteshvara mean? I won't go through the boring etymology, but it means one who looks down with compassion. Okay? So when it gets to Tibet, you know, hundreds of years later, the Tibetans rename it. They don't call it Avalokiteshvara. Why? Well, Tibetans don't speak Sanskrit. They don't know what that means. So it just becomes a name like Sally or Jim or, you know, Peter, something. But the name is supposed to communicate a way of being. So they renamed it Chenrezig, which is Tibetan, and we call it Chenrezig practice. And I bet you, how many here know what Chenrezig means? Not many, and yet we do this practice all the time. Chenrezig means loving eyes. So when you do this practice, think about doing loving eyes practice. When you do loving eyes practice, it changes everything. In fact, you can do loving eyes practice right now. We don't have to get the texts out and do the formal practice. I mean, nothing wrong with that. I like the practice, and it's got a lot of elements, like I said, that train our minds to operate in a compassionate and kind way. But take a moment right now, close your eyes, and think to yourself, loving eyes, and try to make your eyes loving eyes. And then open your eyes back up and look around with loving eyes. This is a practice you can do all day long. You know, when you look at somebody with loving eyes, it may be just what they need to relieve their suffering in a given day. That's probably happened to you. You can do that. You can do that for whatever you meet in your day. We just have to remember to practice loving eyes. It's very powerful. It's so simple. You don't need words. I don't know if you've noticed this, but when you look that way, it automatically creates some space, some openness. Some of that quiet that Karmapa talks about just automatically comes when you practice loving eyes. You kind of have to get rid of your, or drop your story. You got to drop your judgments, your labeling, because whatever it is, you're just taking it in with loving eyes. So this is a way of combining the wisdom of openness and the luminosity of having an alive mind that's alive in the atmosphere of loving kindness. I'm not an enlightened being, but for me, so far, it just doesn't get any better than that. Everything seems to come together to support that, you know, whatever practices I do, and so forth. They're very necessary for me to actually be able to pause in my day and remember this simple loving eyes. So that's why I wrote this dedication of merit that you have, and I'd like to end the talk here with that practice. and do this dedication of merit together. And then there's time left, so anybody who's got any questions or comments, I'm happy to receive all of those and do my best to respond. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of loving eyes. May we find refuge in the open state, free from fixation, which naturally dissolves the reactions of self and other. May anyone who merely sees, hears, remembers, touches, or talks to me be freed in that very instant from all sufferings and abide in happiness forever. May we experience the unchanging expanse of awareness directly. May we awaken in one lifetime, which is the endless accumulation of merit. Well, thank you all. So, questions, who's got them? Well, if there are none, go to the question mic, please, because people are watching online and that way they can hear.
Thank you so much for your talk today.
Thank you for coming.
I thought of a question. It's not exactly the theme of your talk, but it came up while you were talking about it, and it's come up for me before. Sort of a common issue that I have with worshiping a human being.
Mm-hmm.
I understand all of the work and the Dharma, and it's had a huge impact on my life, but the piece of where it sort of feels like it's a worship of a human being, of a man,
mm-hmm.
in particular for me, is difficult. I was wondering if you have any thoughts about that.
Oh, lots of them.
I figured.
Yeah, I think I shared that at one point, actually. It felt a little odd, especially coming from the culture that we come from, where statues were kind of forbidden and worshiping a human being as opposed to a transcendental being, a transcendent being, a little odd. And I want to say that the components of my own path were something like this. I started meditating in 1974 because I was crazy. And I was suffering, and people thought I was happy, but inside it was just, boy, it was a mess. And I was trying everything. So I learned meditation from Swami Chaitanananda back then. And I practiced for a long time. And went through all kinds of different traditions and so forth. The meditation was consistent, but the traditions and, you know, the environments that I became a member of changed from time to time. Until 1996, when I saw a picture on a telephone pole in the short north of a guy who was going to be given a public talk. And it was His Eminence Thaisithu Rinpoche. And I just looked at him, and I said, I gotta see this guy. So I went to the public talk that Friday night, and boy, he really, really, his presence really engulfed me in a way where all I could think of was, that's who I want to be when I grow up. And you got to understand, by 1996, let's see, I was 44 or 45 years old. You know, it was like most people thought I was grown up. I mean, I had a job and kids and stuff. And over time, I got more deeply involved with Columbus KTC, and I started following the Dharma path. And what I learned was, there's no real problem with if you want to have some sense of a transcendent being in your life, good, no problem. The beauty of the Buddha being essentially the ultimate head of all the lineages, the beauty of that is that he actually was an ordinary guy who had an aspiration similar to mine. He was suffering. And in a response to suffering, rather than trying to get richer than he was, and he was already pretty well off, he was kind of the prince of a small kingdom, or trying to get more powerful than he was, or all the things that we do to try to band-aid over our sense of disconnection and suffering, because we only have that one part of the mirror. He had the good, what shall I say, the merit, probably accumulated in many, many, many lifetimes, that all came together, and he was inspired to follow the path of meditation, which is kind of where you are. You're following that path of meditation, and it's doing you some good. He eventually, through following that path, got a stable realization of how the whole thing is, what the whole mirror looks like when it's all put back together. And he at first thought, I don't know if there's any way I can tell anybody about this. And he was silent. This is the way the story goes, right? And then one of the transcendent gods, this was the Hindu tradition, so it was Indra, the king of the gods, came to him and said, hey, I can see what's happened here. This is great. You've got to teach all these people this. And he thought about that and what he would teach. And he began at that point to teach. And he taught until he was passed away at about 80 years old. But it's not a matter of worshiping Buddha. There isn't any such thing. There's devotion, respect for his accomplishment. There's complete love, because his whole accomplishment is him telling you that you can do the same thing and here's how to do it. Because that was his gift, that was his generosity, was he wanted for sure to everybody to completely pass beyond suffering. That's his heart's desire at that point, right? So the idea of worshiping is a little bit off. It's not that.
Yeah.
And if you need to worship, and there's good cause for that, I think it opens your heart in a certain way. That's fine. Find a way to do that. But Buddhism is all about not worshiping the Buddha, but it's like a deep gratitude of a parent or a lover who kind of pulls your ass out of the muck and says, here, I'm going to dry you off and I'm going to help you walk on dry land here for a while and have a better time of it. They pull you out of the swamp. I think I mentioned the swamp before. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's a little different. I don't think Buddha wants your worship. What Buddha wants is your enlightenment.
I think where I get confused is in our culture when we see statues.
Yeah.
You know, that translates to me as a form of, can be a form of worship. So if when I see some of the Buddhist temples I follow online have mm-hmm. like massive statues.
We're gonna have one.
I saw the one downstairs, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that's supposed to represent your own nature to you. Like who you are when you grow up. It's not supposed to represent an idol who, if you do everything just right, they're gonna drop some blessings on your head. It's not like that. It's not like if you do a certain thing in a certain way, you'll get a boon. And that was why the Buddha was actually revolutionary in the Indian culture. Of course, they had a lot of pantheon of gods. And if you did things just right, you were supposed to get a boon, blessing, something you wanted, or avoid something you didn't want. Buddha says, nah, it's not like that. It's not like that at all. That's a whole other talk. But it's a matter of shifting gears in our heads. Yeah, of course, because of our culture, we look at a big statue like that and we think of it as an idol, because that's the way we were brought up, right? Mm-hmm. And you're not supposed to have any idols. But from the Tibetan culture, what it's supposed to do is to represent your own sacred nature, what you're really like. So every time you see that, every time that you prostrate before that, what you're doing is you're prostrating before your own enlightened nature. That's the idea. And it requires, the prostration comes because humility is required. We have to drop our own egocentric sense of self. This me has to kind of dissolve over time's heart. Yeah. But that's what it's about. The prostrations are a physical way of reminding ourselves, using our body, of the humility that we need to have. And that humility is dropping this false sense of self. And the statue is a representative of who's actually in there, what's actually in there, what it's all about. You can see it, you know, if you go online, there's lots and lots and lots of video of the Dalai Lama, let's say. He's definitely an exemplar. Talk about loving eyes. Whether he's happy, sad, angry, whatever emotion he seems to be exhibiting, if you look at his eyes, even in a video, you can see loving eyes. And so, you know, that's your potential. That's your potential too. That's all the statue is. It's just your potential.
That makes sense. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I know it's a big adjustment. I think we, all of us in the West, have to go through it. It's part of our path.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for asking. Well, now I've gone 5 minutes too long. So, oh yeah.
Sorry,
one more.
I just wanted to sort of
add real quickly, you know, I think it's an interesting topic. You know, I mean, being a Westerner, we did really grow up, I really did grow up, you know,
right,
with Jesus and all that. But I think one of the things that I do like about Buddhism is that, especially Tibetan Buddhism, is that in addition to the Buddha, the statues, you know, you also have like Green Tara, and you know, mm-hmm. we've got female deities that sort
yeah.
of, you know, help balance out that kind of like, you know, gender mm-hmm. equity type of, you know, idea. And I think I try to keep that in mind because it's, you know, I just want to say thanks for the topic as well.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for coming. I really appreciate you. It's like made my day. So have a great rest of the day. And yeah, may all beings benefit.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.